Welcome back to the Journey Podcast. I'm your co-host, Emma Jackson.
And I'm Jose.
And we are joined today by Chris Howard. Thank you for being here today, Chris.
Sure, happy to be here.
Yeah, so for those of you that don't know, Chris is the CEO and founder of Softech, a full-stack development company that started in 1997 and has continued to be at the forefront of innovation for custom hardware solutions and software development. Chris is also an active angel investor and now venture capitalist, and he's a startup mentor here in Houston. He's invested in over 50 companies worldwide. It's pretty freaking impressive.
Trying.
Yeah. We are just so glad to have you here with us today. It's not often we get to sit down with such a seasoned entrepreneur and investor like yourself. So I feel like there's a lot of information that we can gather and pick your brain.
Well, still trying to learn, so I'll do my best to share my mistakes.
Yeah, I saw in your LinkedIn profile that you're like a lifetime entrepreneur. How's that journey been for you?
Yeah, I like to say that I never had a real job. For some reason, I've always tried to be entrepreneurial. I saw it as an opportunity to really kind of break out past, you know, having a day job. Closest I came was as a co-op position at IBM down at NASA when I was going to school at University of Houston.
What year was this?
Ancient history, but I came to Houston in 1981, so that's when I started college. So we're talking about, you know, 83 to 85. Probably at NASA it was 85, thereabouts.
Clarification, you were for NASA or for IBM?
I was working for IBM at NASA during the space shuttle days.
That's so cool.
It was pretty interesting because this is pre-internet, and so IBM actually had an internal network that you could even publish programs that you had written for the company, and you just had to put on the program what they call IUO, internal use only, and so you could share it. The whole point was, hey, IBM's pretty big, and there might be other departments that could use your software, and then you could see who downloaded it, and you could communicate, but you could really learn a lot. And that's where I really learned that the expert was the guy who actually read the manual.
So how did you transition into starting Softech?
Yeah, so I co-op down there for about 2.5 years, and this was at the beginning of the PC revolution. You know, I had the department's only PC, was in the hallway, and I convinced my manager to put it on my desk.
Oh, wow.
And there was an engineer there that joked, hey, why don't you become an expert on this thing? And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. So after about 2.5 years, there's other engineers there. I didn't have my degree yet, but other engineers were doing side jobs and consulting. And so I actually printed up some consulting cards. And I had a family. I had two young kids. And you know, just trying to, you know, do what I could to provide for my family and to learn and grow. And thought, you know, if I could sell like a toolkit online, I could make a lot more money than my co-op salary, right? And so I started experimenting with that and running ads in the back of PC magazines and stuff like that. And how do I get an 800 number? You know, how do I start a business? But back then, of course, it meant like trying to find places like SCORE, which is the Society of Retired Executives, and getting like printed out copies of what the difference is between a sole proprietorship and a company, and just started to try to learn, you know, how to run a business, how to advertise, how to ship something, how to duplicate floppies, how to create a manual.
Completely from scratch and pre-internet days, basically.
Yeah. Exactly. I was just thinking that.
Was that like nights at the library? What did that, I mean, genuinely, where did you find that pathway?
Yeah, and how do you even copy the floppy?
Yeah, there were actually floppy duplicators back in the day, but at first it was manual. But there's some interesting problems, like how do you get a manual printed in smaller batches? Because they were too small for a book printer and too big for like the copy place, you know? So, but there weren't places in Houston like there are today to go to find other entrepreneurs. It wasn't like a software industry per se, and so, yeah, looking back, I guess I must have run across SCORE, and I tried to at least find what I could on, you know, business and starting a business and talking to the bank and getting an 800 number and things like that. But it was there weren't a lot of mentors back then, that's for sure.
I'm so curious on something. Is the banking practices changed over the years from like the 90s, 80s, 90s to how to get lending or funding today?
Yes and no. I mean, I was able to set up like a credit card account, and I was running my business out of my house, right? And so, you know, how do you accept American Express? How do you accept Visa and MasterCard? Found a bank that was willing to give me a credit account. But, you know, for most of my journey, going to the bank and trying to get a loan was just, you know, nearly impossible because it's a software business. They don't understand the bits, you know, it's a services business, or most of my business has been offshore. And so I don't have the assets that banks normally would loan against, right? So often the answer was usually, well, how large a loan can I get? The answer was usually zero. I'm like, how could it be like zero? I mean, no amount of money. And then other times when I would get like 100K or something and try to like build the relationship, it was still very difficult, you know, to get them to expand that credit line because there just wasn't anything there for them to collateralize, right? And so I think some things have changed. I remember I had a big contract with HP and Disney, right? And about halfway through, there just wasn't any money coming through this big behemoth pipeline, right? And it was a 6-month project, and I needed the funds in order to deliver this thing on time. But I had signed off invoices for hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? I go to the bank, it's like, I need a credit line to finish this project. I'm working with HP and Disney. They've signed these off. And the guy actually looked at me across the table, and he goes, well, HP could go out of business tomorrow.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Yes, quote, oh my unquote. Gosh. Yeah, I'm like, well, this is what you're dealing with, right? Where they see risk.
So right? What did you do? How did you find the you know, the assets? Or I guess it would be the money to bridge that
yeah, gap. I mean, that's the whole thing with entrepreneurship is problem solving, right? You know, first I told that guy, well, I could leave this office and get hit on a head by a meteor. That's also possible, but not likely. So it's not likely HP is going to go out of business.
Wasn't HP trading publicly back then?
Oh, yeah. It was a big company. Yeah. So it's probably bigger than it was
really
now.
Really established.
No, it was just ludicrous. But so what I did was I went back to HP and I said, look, you want me to deliver this thing on time? You need to get me some money, mm-hmm. right? And so they did finally like clear that dam and get me the funds. And I delivered the product. It was our first hardware product. I was still, at that point, it was Softek, so I was running the business out of the house. And, you know, back then, though, I mean, people ask me, how did business change with COVID? I'm like, well, the world caught up to me because I was running the business out of the house. We did homeschool our kids. You just didn't really talk about it much because you weren't a real business back then. So it ended up to be the most successful product. Disney said, wow, that's the most successful hardware product we've ever developed because we developed, you know, we shipped 5,000 headsets from scratch, designed, built, delivered firmware, software in 6 months, plus a custom unit battery charger. But yeah, that was just explaining, hey, if you want me to succeed, this is what I need from you. He was actually relieved after the conversation. He's like, I thought you were gonna tell me something really bad. I'm like, well, this is, the interesting thing to me on that project was the hardest thing was not the technology. It wasn't the software. It wasn't creating our first hardware product. The challenge was getting the financing, right? Getting the money,
but I like
managing the budget.
But you asked. I think a lot of times entrepreneurs might be afraid to ask or to push that boundary. So if you're turned away, I mean, I was in the same position when I took over the Idea Farm because we're a marketing agency, and this was pre-COVID too, and our assets are, you know, our employees and our IP essentially. And it can be hard for the bank to look at that and especially when we had a lot on like the tech side, and it's hard to for them to see. And it wasn't until I partnered with Jose that he started really sharing a lot of more in-depth knowledge about how to kind of play that game, how to talk the talk for banks and what they care about. But I mean, that's that even in the world of the internet, I didn't even know the questions to ask to find that information.
Yeah, it's an important point. I'd say one of the lessons learned is you need to really ask for what you need, right? So and investors and partners want to know what you need, right? So whether you're a founder getting investments from LPs or you're asking your mentors, I've had other opportunities. I remember one specific opportunity I had to build a team for, I think it was SanDisk, but at the time, they wanted me to build a team of 20 firmware developers, and they wanted me to do it quickly, right? And I talked to them, and I thought, well, I need $500,000 in order to do this, right? I talked to my CFO, and he said, well, I said, well, should I ask for the 500K in addition to, you know, getting this deal for 20 people for a long-term contract? He said, well, it's better to get the deal, don't screw it up, right? And I actually didn't take his advice because I thought, well, I need to tell them what I need to do here. And I went ahead and asked for the 500K and I got it, right? And then that was instrumental in me being able to succeed at that time. So I'd say there's 2 points there. One is ask for what you need, right? Mm-hmm. And two is the second point is sometimes you have to ignore the advice of your mentors, right? And, you know, so, you know,
and trust your gut.
Trust your gut. I mean, his heart was in the right place. That is that there's you're going to be given a lot of opinions when you're a startup, right? And a founder. If you do go and ask your mentors, and your job is to sort through really what advice you take and what advice you don't take.
I think it goes back to risk tolerance in a sense, because like we had a CFO that was very traditional. He wanted to run the books in a certain way. And I'm like, for the vision and the growth I have for this company is like, we need to take a lot more riskier ventures. And, you know, they're calculated, but we had to push the boundaries. Mm-hmm. I think finding the right team to support our journey, our vision, crucial.
And I also think that's a great example of having a team that maybe he didn't quite understand our business model in depth, and because of that, didn't understand the risks that we could take that actually weren't that risky, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And because mm-hmm. we are in a similar, very similar sort of business where when we work on large scale projects, you know, we'll have big chunks of money come in here and there. And we've been in the same situation where it's like, okay, but how do you span this? And we've just started communicating our needs. When we're working on big projects, you know, we wrapped up a project with the city government and we redid their website and their branding and everything. And so much of that can be on hold for a long time because there are 17 different departments that need to approve everything. But our work is done for this particular phase. And so we've learned how to communicate and say, hey, this is how, you know, if you want to continue to work with us and we want to provide this for you, we're going to have to get some support over here. Because with bigger projects, a lot of times your clients may not even know, but smaller agencies are often staffing just for specific projects. Because why else would you keep, you know, we have a really lean team, but if we're building out a project for a really big client, we're going to build out a team for that as well.
Yeah, so. As a smaller company, I often feel like you're a little speedboat going around the aircraft carrier. Yeah. And their timelines are so long and you're like a mayfly or something, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, come back to us in 12 months. And you're like, well, maybe.
I know.
I think working with companies that have to get board approval between like every single step and milestone, mm-hmm. that's like the most like for me, because I like to move fast. I'm like, okay, we're just going to take a month to get that next approval. So just having that patience is key.
Yeah, corporate clients, you know, you're looking at 6 to 18 months for even decisions whether to move forward or not, right? Mm-hmm. So you just need to keep that in mind when you're trying to win those contracts. You can win them. I mean, I've always been able to win projects with large logos. I've always viewed, you know, business as like, because I'm a software developer, right? You know, an API, right? So when I started Softech and my first client was Compaq, I could have started as Chris Howard Consultant. Right. Mm-hmm. But then I understood that if I set up a business and now I'm a business and Compaq is communicating with Softech, the company, at some point during the project, a couple months in, they're like, wow, Softech's the only one that's actually delivering their parts of this project on time. Let's give them more work. Right. Mm-hmm. And they would never have done that if it was just me, even though I was really
because
almost the whole company. Right?
They didn't understand capacity.
Yeah. And for a long time, my business cards also didn't say like founder or CEO, because I'm like, well, why would the founder and CEO be actually here coding my project, right? And so I always wanted to give the impression that Softech was, you know, a larger business, you know? And uh-huh. even today, when you look at, I call it an API, but we still have a website. We still have sales at softtech.com. We still have accounting at softtech.com. We have 800 numbers and phone numbers. It's just the difference has been it started out with Chris being me, myself, and I behind the scenes, and now, you know, 400 people worldwide, but still that same API interface.
This makes me so happy to hear, because when I I ended up taking over the Idea Farm, which was my my dad's business after he passed away in 2019, and I didn't. And then that's before I met Jose, before I got into understanding about how to honestly operate and run a business. And all I knew was I had been a website designer, more on the UX UI design side, and then some basic coding. And I could do front end coding and front end development. So I was like, that's what I know how to do that. And I know how to do storytelling. And so at the beginning, it was definitely just me. And I would be selling and, you know, but people didn't quite realize that. And it's good because then I was able to build it. I mean, now we have a really great team. We have a large capacity, but it all came from I did the thing, you know?
Well, you scale behind the scenes, mm-hmm. right? And then it's also important never to lie about it, right?
Yep.
You know, so, but it doesn't mean you can't give the impression that you're a professional business and that you have, you know, these resources available and, you know, you have a plan. So, you know, as I got more work, I just hired more people, right? And mm-hmm. scaling behind the scenes and then still delivering. And the key there also is it turns out if you do what you said, when you said, for how much you said, your clients keep coming back to you.
Exactly.
Right? So you have to build that trust.
I got a question. You were talking about selecting, like when you have a lot of mentors, you have to select and choose what advice you take and you have to pretty much act on it. Did you have mentors growing up in your business journey?
Yeah. You know, looking back, not so much. First of all, there weren't like places in Houston where you could find other people, where founders were, you know, meeting and collaborating. I didn't know quite where to look. I remember a long time people say, well, you must know a lot of founders in Houston. And the reality was I didn't. I had my head down working. I'm trying to build my business. My clients are West Coast, East Coast, worldwide. I actually had more clients outside of Texas than inside of Texas. And, you know, I'd say looking back, I would have changed that. And, you know, there was no LinkedIn, right? There's no way to kind of reach out and find these. You know, when I started out, email was something companies did internally. My first company, I had a company before SoftTech for 10 years, but my first company, I was running email software. It only emailed internal, right? There was no emailing Compaq or something like that, right? There was no way to connect with professionals. There was probably some other ways to do it. I think it's something that a lot of founders don't rate highly enough is building that network out. I think my mentors and my network ended up to be like my clients. Right. And so SoftTech grew because I formed relationships with people. We delivered products for them. I established trust with them. And then they would move from one business to another. You know, an example is I had one champion. I met him at NVIDIA. We did a project for him at NVIDIA. He went to Nike. We did a project for Nike. He went to Intel. We did a project for Intel. He went to Rivian. We tried to get a project for Rivian. You know, it's very relationship driven, right? But, you know, if I was starting a company now, there's so many more opportunities to build out your advisors and your mentors and to learn from people. I'd say that's really why I started the Venture Studio was I saw a gap here in Houston. There wasn't something similar to what you would find in California and the startup community there where founders could go get funding, but not, you know, that's what the venture fund is for, but to actually get that mentorship, which is similar to like a Techstars or a 500 Global. But it wasn't something that was here. And so we started a studio where founders could actually, so we could give our experience and mentor startups and founders and teach them about the mistakes that we've made over the years. And then the other side of that though is you need startup founders that are coachable and that will listen to that, right?
It's a combination of both.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand. I mean, I had, you know, my lawyers, my CFOs, my other people, you know, I would try to ask questions. I was always trying to learn, right? I mean, constant learning is something that's something you always have to do.
Yeah.
You know, how do I start a venture fund? How do I start a venture studio? How do I build a business? You know, how do I do these things?
It's funny because my first couple mentors were my CFO, like my accounting firm.
Mm-hmm. Business lawyer.
He's like, this is how you wrote this deal? This is how you actually write this deal. He's like, oh yeah, you're being exposed over here. And then Neo's like, hey, if you actually charge this way and this different model, you can make more money or mm-hmm. your cash flow can improve. And
you can decrease your tax burden or whatever it may be.
And yeah. Mm-hmm. How to structure your actual entity correctly so you can be more sheltered and stuff like that.
Yeah, you have to be open to that coaching. Certainly listening when people are offering that unsolicited advice. And then...
Oh, for me, it was definitely... I was asking a lot of questions.
More importantly, yeah. Go ahead and ask those questions. That is how you learn. How did you do this, right? How, you know...
And I have to know, because you have such a really well-tenured career, what is the most powerful piece of advice you feel like you've ever received?
Most powerful? It's always hard to find. Like,
I know, that the
most
one.
Powerful. I would say maybe one very useful piece of advice for me that I've always tried to keep in mind did come from my lawyer at the time. And he said, keep your own hands clean. And what he meant by that is, if you're all, you know, besides the fact always trying to do the right thing, but a lot of people will get into a legal agreement or a legal disagreement and start trying to like battle it out and do things that, you know, might not be looked on well. If you imagine like in a legal disagreement, if you're standing in front of the judge and you have to explain why you did certain things, right? Mm-hmm. You want to be up there with like nothing on your hands, like I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't try to do this thing. That has colored my approach to agreements. I mean, part of that is also my how I've always felt about building trust with people. And you have to have a certain amount of morality, of course, in business. But that's been something that I've found, you know.
It's interesting.
Useful.
My lawyer gave me kind of the same advice, but mm-hmm. he did it from a perspective like, think about the cost it's gonna cost you, not just monetarily, but to go and fight this, to go and, like, is it just worth it just to take the L, take the loss, and just clean your plate? You know, your reputation's intact, your company's intact, and you're not muddying yourself through a legal dispute. So,
yeah.
I can resonate with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, in this case, what it meant was, this was a legal dispute very early in my career, and mm-hmm. it was about the contract, and I had the source code for the project that I was working on that they had been paying me to do, and then I withheld the source code, mm-hmm. right? And so at the time, it seemed like, well, I'm not going to give this source code because we don't have this agreement mm-hmm. in place. But, you know, to his point, well, you know, they had paid for it. The other thing that happened was I had actually stored it on a write once read mostly optical cartridge drive that was actually owned by the company. So technically, like, I could, their way around it was like, well, you have property that we own, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, this, if again, as you imagine, you want to be doing the right things so that when you're up there talking to the judge. But mm-hmm. to your point, I mean, I very rarely, if ever, you know, found myself in court. And you always have to make those assessments of like, well, it's going to cost me $50,000 mm-hmm. to litigate this. The guy owes me $25,000. What am I going to do about it? And in many cases, what I've decided was not to go that route. And I've had clients that have owed me money come back to me many years later and do mm-hmm. business with me, right? Because I didn't hold a grudge and mm-hmm. I didn't try to go after them. And I said, that's fine. You know, I get it. You know, things happen. And, you
gosh,
know,
this perspective back, so. Is so good yeah. because I was, when I tell you I was so naive, mm-hmm. I had no idea. And my parents had run this family business as sort of a handshake deal situation. Mm-hmm. They had come from that, you know, there were no written contracts. And I remember my first summer, I had someone, just like a really nasty character, basically not pay. And then when we were like, no, you really do, you need to pay us, you know, it was over like $10,000, which at the time was a lot of money for us. Mm-hmm. And it was us to an outside contractor. And they then, because they had, you know, the owner's son was a lawyer, sent over this super scary, like, we're going to sue you for defamation and da da da. And that was my first time being like, oh, you could not do anything wrong, but in the United States of America, you can get sued for anything. And if someone has the money, they can bully you. They can push you around.
They don't have to be right.
No, they don't have to be right. And then they knew that they had the resources that we were going to, A, have to drop it, and B, they had the resources to kind of to scare us away. And that's where I've learned knowledge is power. And working with the right kind of team, setting up contracts really effectively to protect both sides. We're all about trust and transparency. But that is for me, I really resonate with that piece of advice, because early on, you don't even think about it. You're like, there's no way, it's not going to happen. And some people are good hearted and they just, you know, can't pay, situations arrive. other people are not so good-hearted, and they will take advantage of you. And I genuinely believe he said he saw a weak opportunity. A young business owner didn't have the, you know, things set up, and he said, I can take advantage of this situation, you know?
Plus, well, you learned a lot. I mean, plus, it doesn't cost anything to send a letter, so don't get, like, all...
worked up. Now I know.
Kerfuffled about that, but you know, anyone can send
a
letter.
Intent.
I had public companies send me. I remember I had the domain name for my first company. They sent me a public, you know, like they like, we're gonna sue you. You're not gonna be using name. All that. You have to stand up for yourself. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it's like there's two sides of everything. Any business thing. There's the trust side, and then there's the legal side. And you don't want to over-legalize the contract and the importance of the contract, because if you have to reach into the file and take the contract out, things are already way in the ditch, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever you can resolve without, you know, depending on the legal agreement, that's what you should do.
That's honestly really solid advice. Mm-hmm. So for everyone out there, if you like this kind of content, please like and subscribe. Comment down below if you have a mentor in your life or there's something that you wish you knew or that you want to learn throughout your entrepreneurial journey. Stay tuned. We're going to have a part two. We're going to talk way more about Chris's role as a mentor, and we're excited for you to follow along with that. Thanks.
See you.